tells me to do, I do.
Because he's 34 and bigger than me. So, hello.
Hello.
Nice to meet you all. How many of you are in the teacher training program? Oh my gosh. That's practically tout le monde. All right. How many of you already teaching? Ah, okay. That whittled it down right quick. How many of you are looking to teach someday? Okay. Well, you're with Kelly, so you're already very advanced yogis. And so a lot of the stuff that we'll talk about today, you might almost think of as a kind of refresher course. And some of the exercises and points that we'll go over will be perhaps useful for you in your classes with your students. So if you think of it in that way, the stuff that you already know about, you can just kind of go along with and think of it as some notes for your next class with your students. Some disclaimers. I have no formal training in psychology. I'm a white heterosexual male, so my point of view is totally skewed. I don't speak for everybody. You do something long enough and, you know, you pick up a few things. So that's, you know, basically what I'll try to do today is share with you some whatever little bits of insight I've gleaned over the years into what, for my money, is a very important topic that very rarely gets talked about. My orientation to life is the Bhagavad Gita, this marvelous text which talks about the eternality of the soul, how we are not the body, we're a spark of energy, a divine being housed within a body. And if we can, through contemplative practice, or yoga, or study of the sacred text, meditation, learn to withdraw our association with the temporary selves, what some philosophers call the little selves, and revert back to the big self, the transcendent, eternal self, then that's where the fun begins. So I try not to get too heavy. In fact, if you can put up with the jokes, we're going to be fine. In fact, I tell so many jokes that one of my students at Hofstra put this cartoon together. I know, it's silly. But for me, the best part of coming to Kelly's place really is getting that deeper level of discussion. So this is not going to be, you know, me, wise guru yogi up here, knowing everything, hipping you into what's going on, and you don't know, so I'm going to clue you in. You know, this is a discussion, it's a dialogue. And I already know from talking with Jami and some others that I'm in for, you know, a bit of a hard time today. That's fine, I don't mind. So ask your questions throughout. You know, don't wait for the end. That's like, let's just open it up as quickly as we can to a dialogue. All right, agreed? All right, so if you have anything at all, if something's unclear, just, you know, throw a yoga cushion at me or something, and we'll get into it deeper. This is the way we're going to do this. We'll have it in two parts from now until 2 o'clock or so? 2:30. All right, 2:30. Then we're going to break for some lunch, yeah? And then pick up again in the afternoon. Just by way of introducing myself to you a little bit, did I ever tell you how old I am? See what happens when you get old? Don't think this isn't going to happen to you. I live on Long Island with my partner, my wife. Our daughter's already grown up and moved out, and my son's been out for a long time. the way I got into this whole thing, lo, these many years ago, I was a student in Paris in 1969. Most of you were still in your last bodies in 1969. And on the Christmas break, I went to London, and someone had told me you should visit the Krishna temple there. So I did. And they were just serving lunch. So, you know, sat around with all these nice people having a vegetarian lunch and talking of what do you do. And so, you know, I'm in college, I'm studying literature, and yeah, what else? Well, I play organ in a, you know, college band. Really? Come with us. So we pile into this Volkswagen minibus, which was, I don't know if any of you know, this deadly machine that used to be on the roads called the Volkswagen minibus. And I said, where are we going? And one of them said, well, congratulations, you're in Krishna's band now. Okay. And about 10 minutes later, we show up, and the door of the van opens, and I'm looking at this door of a building that looks vaguely familiar. 23 Savile Row. Wait a minute, that's Beatles headquarters. What the hell? Remember, you got to remember, this is 1969, right? Beatles are still together. Barely, but they're still together. So we walk in, and everyone's, you know, kind of waving to these devotees, people in robes and, you know, wearing their beads. And we go downstairs, and sure enough, there's George Harrison. And all throughout that lunch, people had been talking to me about how, you know, in the bhakti tradition, you can have sex with God. You know, you can rise to the level of such an ecstatic love for the divine that it's like erotic love. So now we walk into this place, and here's a Beatle. And so I'm thinking to myself, okay, I'm thinking about it. Let me get this straight. If I stay with these people, I get to record with the Beatles, and I get to have sex with God. I'm in. So anyway, that book over there is a biography of George Harrison, because he was so encouraging and so supportive and just a really, really decent human being. So that after he passed away, I wanted to express some thanks to him. So I wrote a book. We're going to get out of this. Okay. We're going to get into all kinds of, you know, interesting stuff. Let's start with your quest. I think some of you have already read Gita Wisdom, which was this little book. It started out as a series of handouts for students, because I couldn't find it, you know, a good introduction to the Bhagavad Gita. So I wrote some handouts. And a friend of mine who is the head of Mandala Publishing in San Rafael, California, said, let's make a book. So that's what that book. So I think some of you have read it and are very angry with me. So why don't we start with some of those questions, and then we'll get into the other stuff. All right? Now, who had some questions they want to ask? I know you're there.
I'll start with my question.
All right, you start with your question.
So the folks that are in teacher training, they know that I had a little bit of a hard time with this book. It got better. And for me, the understanding of at the end was that, so I want to do that as a context, because for me at the end it got better, thank God. But at the beginning I had a really hard time because, and I told you this a few minutes ago, I was in the military and I relate warriors to the warriors and the heroes that I know. So for me, imagine a Special Forces Green Beret, Army Ranger, Navy SEAL, I mean, the list goes on. Delta Force, whatever. And they really don't hesitate. And if they hesitate, they die. And if any person around them hesitates, someone else can die. So when I'm looking at Arjuna, who is the one that I have the problem in the story, not Krishna. I actually like Krishna's answer because he's a little sarcastic and mean sometimes. And I was like, yeah. But for me, Arjuna's hesitation really kind of made me not like him at all. and I felt that he was weak. And I'm like, if you're a warrior, and this is your purpose in life, and you've done this before, why are you hesitating now? I mean, why are you not, you know, you wouldn't have made it through selection in this kind of, you know, like, army or anything like that. So for me, it was really hard to comprehend why exactly he hesitated and why he kept questioning, and knowing the journey was, or the conversation lasted several hours. You know, like, I can put it back in the historical context and how they fought back then, but just, I look at him through the now. Okay.
All right, it's an excellent question. And interestingly, it's not unrelated to our topic. So I'm going to connect this with our theme today. But just by way of a preface, let me tell you that I've never been in the military, but I was born in a Jewish family. So by constitution, I'm from the warrior caste.
Not,
right. The other hat that I wear at Hofstra is Holocaust studies. And some of the books and stuff that I've done have to do with international law and war crimes law. So you're touching on a topic that I've had a little background in. And the connection with the theme of the eros of yoga is that there's a right way and a wrong way to do everything. Arjuna's hesitation was not because he had somehow lost his military prowess, his courage in battle, his strength, his determination completely, but rather he was having a moment of doubt because he was uncertain as to the legitimacy of the battle. Now, you no doubt know this from your training, that yes, an army runs on obedience and discipline. And without that, there is no such thing as an army. Take the situation, for example, of a soldier in the Israeli army who is told by higher command, I want you to go in and dismantle the homes in this occupied territory because they're illegal. Now, maybe your allegiances are elsewhere. And maybe you're not even really sure about the legitimacy of that order. Is it legal or is it not legal? Or to take another example, going back to the period I'm familiar with, take the case of a concentration camp guard who is ordered to shoot prisoners if they cross a certain line. And as a guard, you see capos or SS taking a prisoner's hat, tossing it over the line, and they have to retrieve it. And you have to kill them when they cross that line. That order has been approved coming down from Reich headquarters in Berlin, according to laws that were passed by the Reichstag in 1936, 37, 38. What do? In international law, there are two things that are constantly at play. One is called necessity and the other is called humanity. Necessity says that if you are aggressed upon, you have the legal right, and according to Bhagavad Gita, you have even a spiritual imperative to intercede and stop, to respond to aggression when aggression happens. And in the pursuit of dismantling aggression, you have the right of necessity. You can do whatever is necessary to achieve that objective. Humanity says that in pursuing that goal, you cannot commit more harm than absolutely necessary. And we have international conventions to guide such behavior. We have the Hague Convention. We have the Geneva Convention, rules of land warfare. We have edicts from different, you know, military commissions, as they're called. So that as a soldier, if you know that this order is illegal on its face, your higher responsibility is to not follow that order. Now, that's very difficult. What do? As a soldier, tell your superior officer, well, time out, I first want to call my family lawyer, and I'll get back to you just as soon as I can, I promise, because I need to find out whether this order is actually legal. And I'll send you a copy of the letter, and I'll keep a copy, because maybe those rules are going to change.
What Arjuna did.
Sure. Right. So you know, the answer is that we continue to struggle with this balance between necessity and humanity. It's not an easy issue. So if anything, what we see in Arjuna is the very correctness of the enlightened warrior mentality, which is to first say, is what I'm about to do the dharmic course of action? Is this actually fulfilling my responsibility as a warrior, or is it breaking it? So that hesitation on his part, while it was perhaps ill-timed, because the battle was about to begin, was not wrong on its face. And the fact that what he was able to do was imbibe those teachings from Krishna and pick up his weapon at the end and do what he had to do, even though it was the one thing that he did not want to do, speaks to his qualifications as a soldier. So I have to appreciate your response to Arjuna, but also differ in that he was setting an example of, if you will, enlightened military conduct, where you don't blindly follow orders. You follow orders, but not blindly. That'll get you into a lot of trouble. Okay? Is that all right?
That's right. No, I do not like, I don't want to say that, because at the end I did get, I think, I can't remember if it's like chapter 13, 14, when you introduced the, this is not really for Arjuna, like it wasn't for him, it was for everybody else.
Well, the tradition says that Arjuna would never have fallen into that kind of position of self-doubt had Krishna not wanted the opportunity to enunciate the teachings. The tradition does say that. Because I don't see the Gita as just some convenient literary construct for putting wisdom out into the world, I accept this as two real people confronting a real dilemma. My personal preference is to say, let's go inside this story and see what's really going on in his head and in his heart. So, great. Thank you. Thanks. I saw your hand went up here.
I just thought it might be noteworthy that Arjuna was also realizing that he was going to have to kill people that he knew and even loved in his life, and so maybe that helps him understand his style. I mean, when you go into army, or go into a war nowadays, I don't think it's common that you see people on the other side that you know that you need to go up with. You know what I mean?
Not like that. Well, not like that, but I'll give you an example. I mean, these warriors, these current day warriors, they don't like killing. If anything, I've actually asked some of them to read the Gita so that they can see that it's okay to have themselves, that they sometimes have themselves. It's just they don't have it while it's happening. They have it way before they go into the battle. But for me, I understood that, oh my God, that's my teacher, and oh my God, all of this. But in military training, it's one of those things that one day a country's your ally and the next they're not.
So, Jami, I'm going to interrupt. I think it's a profound topic, and I thank you for bringing it up. But I think rather than taking up too much time with that one question, I asked, and you answered, so thank you for answering. So dare I ask if there are any... Does anyone have a short question they would like to ask? Yeah.
Something to the effect of better to fail on the path you must succeed
right.
on one that's not your path.
Yeah, yeah. Good.
Where's the must coming from?
Must?
Yeah, the must. That seems like the key word to me.
Say it again. Where does the must?
Better to fail on the path you must. I don't know the exact.
Better to perform your own duty, even if imperfectly, than to follow someone else's path.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, look, let's drill down a little bit. You come to yoga class, and you see other people doing the asanas, and you go, oh my God, how does she do that? You know, and you really wonder whether you can ever look like that or be that proficient in yoga. This might be a simplistic example. That other person is looking at you and saying, I don't know how she manages to be so uncomfortable with herself. You know, this is so painful for me. So it's all rather relative. And what attracts us to another life or another path than the one we have is this sense that, you know, the grass is going to be greener on the other side, that somehow the life I have is not sufficient. It's missing too many things. It's imperfect. I need to go a different way, and I need to have some other path than the one I have. In some cases, that's correct. You know, we have to be smart enough to know when to get out. More often than not, and this has been my experience, is people just don't like the hard work. You know, you don't want to dig in to really go deeper in what your path is, what you have to get done, because it's hard, you know? If I just did that... So in a kind of general way, what Krishna is pointing to is the tendency that we all have to avoid a painful dharma, an uncomfortable dharma. And yet, as we learn in Bhagavad Gita, it's very often the one thing, what is it about this world? I don't know. The one thing that you're most afraid to do, the one thing that you keep going in the other direction from, is the one thing that keeps slapping you in the face time and time and time again. Until we, what Ursula Le Guin calls, embrace the shadow. Until we learn to accept that I didn't have to be so afraid of this. You know, and then you can move on, right? I mean, that was Arjuna's dilemma. Arjuna had hit the bottom. You know, he was in this place where there was no out. You know, it's what Joseph Campbell calls the belly of the whale. Life as it was before is never going to be the same again. This is a turning point now. Either I'm going to die here, or I'm going to transform. Both paths are scaring the crap out of me. I don't want to die, but I don't know if I can do that. The one thing that I have to do, I don't know if I can do it. So, okay, I tell you what, we're going to jump to the bottom line, and then you can leave, because the rest is pretty much all embellishment about this. The bottom line is this, and whether it's in sex, or whether it's in your job, or whether it's, you know, in the military, or whatever your situation is, here's what the Bhagavad Gita has to say. Get over yourself. Will you please? Just please get over yourself. You know, you are a divine being. You are this beautiful, complete, perfect, fully equipped and outfitted person. You are not the product of all of your life's traumas. That's not who you are. Where are those traumas now? They're in the past. They're gone. So get over it. Just kind of get back on track and live your life. And embrace the adventure of that life, because, man, it's a trip. It's exciting and it's fun and it's everything you always wanted life to be. You know, somehow we get stuck in these places. So thank you for... What's your name?
Troy.
Troy, thanks for bringing that particular verse up, because it kind of gets to the foundation of everything. Okay, I can tell already that these questions are going to really, you know, put me on the ropes. So I'm going to stop asking. I'm going to come back to your questions later, right? So let's get into the formal part of this. I'll try to not make this longer than necessary, but it'll give us the information that we can have to share together and play off of. Okay. How many of you ever lost a friend or a family member to cancer? Okay. This lovely person was a dear friend who died some years ago from cancer. And very spiritually evolved person. Very spiritually evolved. And I loved her dearly. And so did one of my closest friends in the world, whose name is Phil. And Phil's this very cool guy. I always tell him. He's from Philly. He's Phil from Philly. Okay. And his mom was the only woman in boxing history to own, manage, and train a world bantamweight champion. Jolton Jeff Chandler was her boy. And her name was Becky. And she had a voice like this from smoking cigarettes all her life. They used to go around the ring whenever a boy win a match, you know, with a big American flag, three times bigger than she is, you know. So that's, you know, Phil kind of grew up in that kind of real hardscrabble world of South Philly. And he had a crush on Rasa like you would not believe. I mean, this was... I had the tragic responsibility of calling him and telling him that she had died. People, I got to tell you, there was a sound that came over the phone when I told him that I won't even try to imitate. It was... It was the loss of the love of his life. I mean, this was beyond crush. This was, you know, soulmate stuff. And that howl that came over the phone was a few different things. It was him recognizing that they would never be now. She's gone. That was one. The other thing, in retrospect, that I was hearing there was his own sense of a loss of his youth, a loss of life as it might have been when we were all younger. And by inference, a fear of death. Very often those tears that we weep at other people's funerals are tears for our own mortality. And if you're really interested in this topic, I recommend this book to you. It's a Pulitzer Prize-winning work by the late psychologist Ernest Becker. What Becker does is to go into the connection between sex and mortality, and drawing primarily on later Freudian theory, he talks about the act of intercourse as an attempt to get control over our own destiny. And you'll find that when I was reading this stuff, I'm thinking, wow, this is reminding me of some verses from Bhagavad Gita and from some of the Puranic texts. What do those texts say? They say that we are by nature pleasure-seeking. That's the first connection, is that we are by nature pleasure-seeking creatures. The Sanskrit term is sat-chit-ananda. Has anyone heard this phrase before? Sat-chit-ananda. Three Sanskrit terms. Sat, S-A-T, means eternal. Dehinosmin yata dehe komara yovanam jara, second chapter of Bhagavad Gita. As the soul goes from childhood to youth to adulthood to old age, so at the end of life does the soul again leave changing bodies to accept another new body. Dhiras tatra namuyati, someone who's a dhira, who's of steady mind, is not bewildered, even by that change of body at death. Now, this is an exercise we can try sometime, but go back to an earlier part of your life, and you will recall living in a child's body. We don't have to do this now, but all right, here's the abridged form that you can do with your students, right? Close your eyes, take a comfortable position, go back to a time... to your earliest memory. Now, it might have been when you were 5 years old. It might have been when you were 6 years old. It might have been. Whatever those early memories are. And it could have been something that happened to you, happy or sad, alone or with others. But something that marked you so deeply that even now you recall it. So now you're back at that moment. Okay, now, when I do this exercise... the full-length exercise here. We'll take a few moments just to let people stay in that place. And then I'll say, now come forward about 10 years. Come forward 10 years. Maybe now you're in your teens or your 20s and recall some other event from life that was a seminal moment for you in your evolution, in your growth, in your development of character, personality, your view of the world, of other people. So I'm abbreviating this for you dramatically, but it can take 10, 15, 20 minutes sometimes. And now come back into the moment. Be back in the room here with us at Happy Buddha and come out of that memory. Okay. So the first question I have for you, how many of you were able to remember an incident from your earlier life? Okay. Where is that body? You were there because you've just recalled that incident, however dramatic, traumatic, happy, sad it might have been. You've just relived that moment. That means you were there. Where's that body, that child's body that you were in when that event occurred? It's gone. Biologically, every 6 or 7 years, the entire molecular structure of your physical body changes. When you wash your hands, and you know that brown, that's not just dirt coming up, that's skin. I cut myself. I had a cut on this finger from gardening. It's the same time I did this that my back's crazy. I put a fence up because we got rabbits out by where we are. And there was part of the chicken wire that kind of broke the skin. It's gone now. Because the body's constantly changing all the time. You can't even see it anymore. Every 6 or 7 years, you have a new body. But consciousness is still there. You remember it. You remember being in those earlier parts of your life. So according to the Gita, one more change of body. Death is one more change of body. Where you go, that's a whole discussion. That's what yoga is ultimately about. The asanas that you practice here are not the goal of yoga. Just ask Kelly. They're the doorway into yoga. The goal of your yoga is to recall, to revive this knowledge of ourselves as spiritual beings, divine beings. This one lifetime is not all in all. And we all have practical experience of that. Nobody has to tell you you're alive. You know you're alive. Right? And you remember being alive in a different body. So what is the nature of that core self, the self that does not disappear when the body dies? Sat-chit-ananda, sat eternal, chit fully self-aware. We're unaware right now, but that's not our natural condition. By nature, we are fully self-aware beings. We know very well who we are, and we know how beautiful we are, and we know how smart we are, and how capable we are. We know that. We know that intrinsically, but something right now has gotten in the way. It's called maya. The Sanskrit word is maya. Maya means that which is not. We've so identified with this temporal self because we're in it. We're so close to the mind, thoughts, and the body, the sensations of the body. We're so close to these things that we think that's me. We actually believe this is me. I wasn't always the debonair, good-looking fellow you see before you now. You know, I mean, that's like we identify with the temporary self because we're living it all the time. That's what your yoga is for. It's to come back to that place where you begin to separate that external covering, like the Gita calls it like a shirt, like a piece of clothing, you know, that when it gets used, you throw it away, you put on a new shirt and say, okay. Diras tattara namuyati. There's no need for the drama over change of body. It's a perfectly natural function. The soul continues to migrate from body to body. Satchit ananda. Ananda means by nature joyful. Why do we seek pleasure? Now we're getting into the topic of ours. It's taking us how long? Half an hour or whatever. Finally got into it. Where does sex impulse come from? It comes from the soul. It comes from that satchit ananda being that is now living inside that body you're wearing. The nature of the soul is that it seeks joy. It seeks pleasure because that is its constituent nature. Why do we run from pain? Pain is as natural in this world as pleasure. Why do we try to avoid pain? It's because pain is not our natural state. The natural condition of the soul, of the Atma within the body, is joy and a pleasurable place. So where are we? We're looking for love in all the wrong places. First, come to know who you are. Then you can understand what makes you happy and what gives you pleasure and joy. Again, if you want a bottom line takeaway from today, you know, if you can't be here after lunch or whatever, you know, if you don't know who you are, how do you know what actually makes you happy? How do you know how to engage in a relationship with someone else and learn to share mutual pleasure if neither of you knows who you are? How do you do that? It's motivated by something else, what psychology would call needs-driven activities. Because we identify with the body, we identify with the frailties of the body. So we're going to get into that in just a moment. So the Gita is straight up a devotional text. And you can get to that devotional root of all wisdom traditions, the mystical root of all traditions, by going inside those more esoteric texts. So there's a book that I use in one of my classes at Hofstra. The course is called Mysticism and the Spiritual Quest. Fills up right away. All you need is a good brand, right? You know, it's like, we use a text by Evelyn Underhill that was written in 1903. It's more than 110 years old now. Still holds up as one of the best texts on mystical experience. And Underhill, she's a fascinating character, British, had her own spiritual teachers as a young woman, collected, assembled whatever available information there was on mystic experience, and came up with a description of mysticism that's a mirror of the teachings of Bhagavad Gita. The symptoms of a mystic experience. What is it? Mystic experience. Woo! What is it? Can I have it? Where do I get one? The descriptions in most of the accounts given by people, most people who have mystic experiences don't talk about it. They keep it and they go away. Are you crazy? Now I've had this, I've seen this, I felt this. You think I'm going back into that? You're out of your mind. So most gurus, most realized beings, you'll never hear about them. You'll never know their names. You'll never meet them. They're never going to come to yoga journal conferences, you know, because they know better. They're out of here. Some, what the Buddhists would call the bodhisattvas, postpone their own entrance into nirvana in order to come back into the world and share what they've experienced, what they've known with others. And what is that experience like? Well, if you read Underhill, there are certain descriptions that seem to repeat no matter what the tradition, no matter what the background, no matter what the age, no matter what the country, no matter what century. There seem to be certain things about what makes us all truly blissful that we share in common. If you're interested in this particular topic, I direct you to the work of Csikszentmihalyi, who's a Hungarian psychologist, and a book that came out in the 80s called Flow, F-L-O-W. Also called optimal experience. I think we might have talked about that in one of our previous gatherings. What are some of those symptoms of real ecstasy? Right? Well, time disappears. You're not thinking about the past. You're not thinking about the future. You're just here in the moment. It's substantial when you're having a mystic experience. When you have true ecstasy, you know it. It's not theoretical. It's not abstract. Every atom of your being knows that this is occurring. Another symptom of that aha moment or that moment of ecstasy is that everything that seemed irreconcilable about your life begins to make sense. Like everything that is just a puzzle. It's just such a... I don't know how I got into this thing. I don't know what it is. I don't know what I'm going to do about it. When that moment occurs, all of that somehow... First of all, it becomes less important. All of the woes that preoccupy us most of the time, they kind of like take their real place lower down on the scale of important things. And here's what something's interesting. It has nothing to do with genitals. The ecstatic experience that's described by the mystics is not the, you know, highly touted, publicized Kama Sutra poses and stuff like that. That's actually for very novice, neophyte beginners in spiritual life. It's there are two paths, right? There's in the Indian traditions. There's Nivritti Marg and Savritti Marg. The sexual tantric path, the Savritti Marg. Sa meaning collecting. Sa, let's basically get all of it, that you get more than you can handle. And you become so saturated with it, you become so fed up with it, that, okay, I've done that, been there, don't want that anymore. That's what the tantric path is trying to do. It's trying to say, is this really what you want? You know, I'm simplifying here, but is that really it? That's what you're going for? You know, a few minutes and then it's all over? The Nivritti Marg path is the path of denial, which is to say, I know that that's Maya. I know that's illusion. I'm not going to go there. I'm not going to make that mistake. So there's a kind of austerity, austere renunciation of sensual life, of the senses, of the body. Well, how long can you live in that closet? Bhakti, Bhagavad Gita, devotion is that middle path. It says you don't need to go crazy, and you also don't need to deny yourself. First, come to know who you are. And according to all the descriptions of people who arrive at that place, the ecstasy that they know sustains. It doesn't end. It's eternal. It's permanent. Can you imagine living in a state of permanent ecstasy? There's a prayer by a King Kulishekar, one of the great Vedic kings. He sang, Krishna tvideya padapankara pundaram tam adaiva visitumi manasaraja pangsa prana prayana kamaye kabavata pitto kandarbaro danavido smananam kutaste. He prays that the pleasure that I've known in this relationship with you, my dear Krishna, he's talking about the Supreme Being, the soul's partner, if you will. He says, this is so great that let me die. Let me die now while I'm thinking about you, because there could be nothing better than this. I'm fulfilled. I don't need anything else. While my mind is clear, while I'm thinking of you, just let me die. I have everything I ever wanted right now, right in this moment. And that's the description in most of the stories in this book by Underhill. Okay, so this Atma, this spiritual entity, who we are, where do these qualities come from? Well, according to the Bhakti texts, they're like sparks emanating from a fire. They have the same qualities as the fire, but in minute quantity. Or another example would be a drop from the ocean of the same chemical constituent elements as the vast ocean, but in small quantity. So we're ecstatic creatures because God is an ecstatic creature. There's only two things. Either this entire creation is emanating from some energetic place that is devoid of personality, devoid of shape, form, name, voice, sense of humor, preferences. In other words, a place of just nondescript Brahman oneness, which is a kind of pseudoscientific perspective, actually. And if everything is energy, devoid of personality. Or there's personality behind this. And I remember the first thing hearing from my teacher, Prabhupada, when I heard one of his classes, it was a recorded class. He said, as soon as you understand that God is a person, everything begins to make sense. Boing! That was one of my aha moments. That as soon as I could understand that there's personhood behind things, that there's personality, there's a conscious dimension behind the energies, that the energetic source is not just nondescript or some bad joke or something. that opened up a whole lot of doors for me. Now, I'm not a religious person. Let me throw out another disclaimer here. In fact, I'm kind of bored by religion. I find most religion kind of yucky. I mean, seriously, you know, what thinking person would take to the kind of religion that you learn about in places of worship? It's not particularly appealing. It's certainly not intellectually very satisfying. But Krishna, he fascinates the heck out of me. Bhagavad Gita, I'm there. That stuff is... So Krishna, and we'll get to Krishna in a minute, because I know a few of you have some questions from reading Gita Wisdom. Krishna is not the god of organized religion. And when we talk about you or me, the Atma, the soul within the body, reflecting the qualities of Krishna, we're not talking about institutional religion and the idea of some divine being on high controlling our lives. That's not what we're talking about. So what do? Do I get into Krishna now, or do I stick with what we're doing? How many of you want to go to Krishna right now and talk about Krishna? I see a few somewhat reluctant hands. Okay, I'll tell you what. Let me get through the formal thing, and then we'll go right. That'll be the next thing we do. How's that? How are we doing? Any questions so far? I mean, this should either be getting you very angry, or, you know, the last thing I want is somebody just falling asleep. So, I mean, if you don't like any of this, just say so. It's okay. Okay. All right, here we go. Second chapter, Bhagavad Gita, that which pervades the bodies of it is indestructible. No one can destroy the imperishable soul. Again, we're coming back to this place, whether it's in the armed forces, or whether it's in bed, or whether it's in the boardroom. Who are we and how are we acting? What is the core motive that moves us forward? Yes.
How does that pertain to his task of slaying his enemies if it's not going to destroy them?
How does the immortality of the soul relate to Arjuna's slaying the enemies in battle? What's the purpose of engaging in battle?
No, what's the purpose of slaying them if it's not going to destroy them?
Oh. The truth of transcendent reality doesn't negate our need to act practically in the world. I mean, that's a big mistake that I made. I mean, I know when I was 19 years old, I walked into a Krishna temple and I thought, oh, now I get it. I'm not this body. I'm an eternal soul. No more family. If you'll pardon the use of this Sanskrit term, no more mishigas. You know? No more of that stuff that I have to deal with otherwise. You know, now I'm a transcendent being. Bad idea. The yoga teachings do not tell you to walk away from a problem. They tell you how to enter deeper into that problem with more effective tools for addressing it. That's what Arjuna learned in the Bhagavad Gita. It's what we're supposed to be learning in our yoga classes. It's not to escape from the world, but how to enter into the world more effectively, more efficiently.
So deal with it on a less spiritual level? A more practical level?
Oh, no. It's not less spiritual, it's more spiritual.
Well, my question is, if it's more spiritual, what's the purpose of slaying his enemies if they're going to...
Because it is a spiritual responsibility that if you see harm being done, you have to intercede. And if you do not, you suffer karmic consequence from your lack of engagement. If I walk outside the door of this studio and I see a child running across the street and there's a car coming, and I don't do anything to pull that child out of harm's way, I am implicated in that violence. You can't walk away from responsibility just by not doing anything. I mean, if we've learned anything from the Holocaust period, it's that so-called bystanders side with the perpetrators, not the victims.
I understand that part. I guess my question is, what happens to the people that he's slaying?
Well,
you know, how does he have an impact on that, or does he?
If.
Or does life just impact what their next journey will be?
Well, now we're getting into another seminar, if you will. That's a deep one.
The souls of the dead, that happens.
Yeah.
It doesn't. It's not. I don't know. This is when he has. I think this is when he. Where he sees the people that he knows, and he doesn't want to kill them. And Krishna, I think, tells him this, and this is how I took it. It doesn't matter if you kill them because their soul is going to live on. And the way that I took that is that you're killing the body that's doing the harm and giving them another opportunity to
okay,
come back.
Okay, right. Here's where, look, I live out on a limb. You know, I don't just go out on a limb, I live there. Okay? So you're likely to hear some stuff from me that you might not hear from people who teach Bhagavad Gita, you know, the usual way. All right, so I'll answer your question. I don't use the word karma very much at all. I mean, I find it a little kind of irrelevant. So while what you're saying is true in the sense of some background cosmic architectural framework that people come to a place through past actions and that we suffer the consequences, suffer or enjoy the consequences of our past deeds, and that is what has brought us to this place. You can't access those previous lives. I find them irrelevant. Whatever it is we may have done in previous lives, okay, there's no hoping for a better past. So forget that. The life that we can deal with is now, the one we're living. Right? So the tools of our enlightenment are engagement with this life. I would much prefer to talk about genetics, DNA, parenting, early childhood trauma. I'd much more talk about social conditions, diet, you know, stuff that impacts our life now, than referencing some theoretical background which may have reality in philosophy, but in real life doesn't really do much. Now, I'm not going to offer you that as some standard Bhagavad Gita teaching, okay? But I'm telling you after 44 years of doing this gig, that for my money, what the Gita is talking about is set aside the philosophy. You know, philosophy is nice, but that's not going to do much for you when you're on the battlefield. Right? Okay. So the answer to your question may be, yes, according to the tradition, they are now purged of their past sinful activity, their harmful activity, and by sacrifice, by giving up their life now, they have a fresh start. Okay, all right. It's very pretty. It's very nice. But I think that, you know, where the rubber hits the road, so to speak, is how do I do this? How do I pick up a weapon? Look, I'm an old hippie, okay? The idea that there's a right way to conduct a battle, I had a hard time getting my arms around that one. Until, you know, I've been in some situations where I can understand that doing nothing means doing harm. And there are times when, you know, so if you want, you know, we're not going to talk politics, right? But I no longer think that there's something unspiritual about being prepared. I believe in being armed because it's a nasty world out there. And if someone comes after me, my family, my place of worship, whatever it may be, I believe that there is a proper way to retaliate. And according to the Gita, it is with ahimsa. Now, how do you reconcile that one? How do you retaliate with nonviolence? Well, you don't do nothing. But what you do with a sense of compassion. And that's where we were talking about humanity balancing necessity. Okay. All right. So again, I think this is another, it's a big issue, big question, because then you got to get into what are the standards of righteousness? You know, who gets to decide what's righteous battle and what isn't? All right, so that's all a whole other kettle of tofu.
Well, I think what you're saying from this conversation is it's just what's right there. In that moment that they're having the conversation and the battle that's in front of them. It's not a whole big three steps down the road thing.
Yeah, it's how to act right now, how to act in this moment. And that you can learn by practice. Yeah, every enlightened person I've met, it's taken them a good 20, 30 years to get to that place where they can live spontaneously from that place of knowing what to do and what not to do. I'm married now 28 years. It took me 22 of those 28 years to figure out what the hell I'm doing. No, I'm being very honest with you. You know, it takes a lot of effort, you know, to get to that place where your instincts and your intuitions are so grounded, they've been proven in the fire of adversity so well that you know how to act, you know what to do, even without having to take that, you know, I'm going to send a letter to my family lawyer, pause. You'll know what to do because there's a kind of intuition that develops. It's a yogic frame of mind. It's a spiritual way of living your life. The Native Americans would call it walking without casting any shadow or leaving any footprint. It's walking through this world in a way that is dharmically correct. That's a very hard thing to do. That's very hard. All right, we're going to come back to the Eros of Yoga. Can we do that? I promised you the Eros of Yoga. You're going to get the Eros of Yoga. Just a couple of it. I love this verse in the Bhagavatam. As the moon reflected on water appears to tremble due to its association with the inconstant water, so the self associated with matter appears to be qualified as matter. We're living within the body. It's like living with the reflection of the moon. Right? The real moon is constant. But we're living with a reflection of our true self. You look in the mirror and who are you seeing there? So we vacillate because just as the reflection on the water seems to vacillate, the moon is steady. So we, the souls within these bodies, we're steady. We're fixed. We don't go through those doubts and that not knowing how to act. The soul has its own integrity, a grounded integrity in its own nature. We've forgotten that. We've been here so long. Like last time I drove up, you know, if I had left my car here since the last time I was here, I came back, it'd be filthy. It'd be filthy. Don't have to do it. Don't have to throw a bucket of dirt on it. Just by sitting there, it would get dirty. That's the nature of this world. Maya, the material energy, covers. You don't have to do anything. Just be in the material world and you're going to start forgetting who you are. Your consciousness is going to get covered. It's just by nature, the nature of the material energy. So that's why yoga, stick with your yoga. Keep doing it. Even if, I love when someone comes up to me and says, Yogeshwar, I've been chanting Hare Krishna now for 6 months and I still don't see Krishna. You know, it's like, 6 months. How many lifetimes have you been in this world? Right? And you want 6 months gratification. You know? Give it time. Come and see me 20 years from now. And then we'll talk. All right? Okay. It's a nice child's body, old person's body. Got it? Okay. Where else? Another one. Child's body, open body. Okay. Yeah, I came back from living abroad for so many years, I didn't even recognize my own family members. Right? Because the body changes. I had been gone for many years. I came back. I didn't recognize anybody. Their bodies had changed. The same person. You know, my mom was still my mom. That's her second from the right. You can't really see it. The body changes. But we, the soul, are within. Now, why am I belaboring this point? Because we can't talk about sexuality without, first of all, establishing who we are. Okay? So even though it's an hour and 6 minutes. This is a necessary prelude to a conversation. Okay, so now, all right, another verse from the Gita, very nice. Okay, so we're constantly changing bodies. We are not the body. Okay, what happens? Because we've forgotten the nature of our true self, that Satchitananda self, the desire for union, which is what the soul originally has with Krishna, or the source of all energies, there's a natural union there, just as there's a natural rapport between a spark and the fire from which it emanates. When we are distanced from that union, we look for it in other places. You don't become asexual. You don't become non-eternal. You're still eternal, but we're going through these temporary lifetimes. You don't become non-self-aware. You become covered. You're still self-aware, but it's covered. You don't become non-sexual. We're still sexual creatures, meaning we seek that union, but because we don't remember what that original sexual nature is like, it's displaced and put into many other shapes and forms, which is the human condition. We are eternal beings inside temporary bodies. We're eternal beings inside temporary bodies. Did you ever have this feeling? Does he want me or just my body? Right. Because most of the time, by which I mean human sexual expression, when it is devoid of self-awareness, when it is devoid of that sense of one's eternal self, it becomes a biological function. It's a mechanical function. The body is constricting blood vessels. There's a release of that constriction. That feels good. Kind of like waterboarding. You know, what is pleasure? It's the release from the need for pleasure. It's a kind of pleasure, but it's certainly nothing like what's described in Evelyn Underhill. In physical sex, devoid of that deeper sense of self, your core identity is left over to the sidelines. And if your real self is irrelevant here, then someone else might as well be there fulfilling that same physical function. You become irrelevant in that. One way to deal with that is what psychologists call regression in service of the ego, which means that during sex, people for some time subconsciously suspend those inner thoughts and introspection and play at being the physical self. We allow ourselves to go into that mindset which says, this is me. And for a while, that is you, and we're going to play. Right? Even sages do this, you know, those who have life partners. So how do they do that without falling prey to the insecurities and after effect of that? Because their sense of self is so well grounded that they can enter into that physical expression of self without feeling the core self threatened and without ever forgetting the core self. You know, in mystic cultures, there's still sexual activity, but it's never harmful. It's never abusive. It's conducted in a larger partnership. I'll never forget this one. You know who Dr. Ruth is? Well, my real question for you is not how often are you having sex, but how's the rest of your life? Do you get out enough? You know. That kind of healthy sexual relationship among partners who are aware of their spiritual being is part of this larger menu, if you will, of moving forward together spiritually. It's part of a larger diet. You know, it doesn't become the focus of the relationship. There's this verse in the Bhagavad Gita which may be the most overlooked verse in the Gita. It's overlooked because people don't know how to explain it. Balam balatvam chaham kamaraga vijarjitam dharma virudo bhuteshu kamosmi bharatarshaba. I am strength. This is Krishna speaking now as that source of energy, the divine from which all beings flow. Right? I am strength free from selfish passion and attachment. That addresses your point about how do you engage in battle? Free from selfish passion and attachment. And in all beings, I am sex which does not oppose dharma, O Arjuna. Right around this point, people sometimes ask me, well, does the Gita support same-sex partnerships? The answer is, The Gita supports any partnership that is spiritually healthy. There's no thou shalt and thou shalt not in the Bhagavad Gita. What you have in the Bhagavad Gita is do that which is spiritually fulfilling and enriching and which moves you forward. And try to stay away from the stuff that doesn't do that for you. It's not there's no condemnation here, but there's a common sense presenting of information, which is find a partner, be happy with that partner, and grow together spiritually. And if you can't do that, take a time out. Go do more yoga. Chant Hare Krishna. Do something that'll enrich you spiritually, and the rest will come. That's the other question that usually pops up right around. Well, how can I find a good partner? Then my real question is, what are you doing with the rest of your life? You know, are you focusing on yourself? Are you giving yourself the attention that you deserve? Are you nourishing yourself spiritually? Because if you are, that's very attractive. I'll give you a hint, because most of you are ladies here in this room. The guys know this already. You know what's really sexy? Intelligence is really sexy. Sense of humor is really sexy. And someone who's self-confident is really sexy. Where does healthy self-confidence come from? It comes from knowing the true ego within the body. Now, you hear this thing sometimes, you know, egolessness. Hooey! There's no such thing as egolessness. You cannot destroy ego. We just read that in the second chapter of Bhagavad Gita. The soul is eternal. Ego means self. How can you destroy something that's eternal? What you can get rid of is all of the, another Sanskrit, all the mishagas. You can get rid of all the stuff that's gumming up the works, all the false ego, all of the mistaken ego. That you want to kind of like get under control. But you cannot destroy ego. So healthy ego, that's a good thing. You want that. That you want. Okay, here we go. You ready? This is part two. Everyone comfortable? You need a bathroom break? You okay? If you need to go to the bathroom, you don't want to ask permission. You don't want to raise your hand. Just go. It's back there. Okay. For a while when I was in therapy, and I've been in therapy a few times over the years, I find it very useful. Martha Friedman was a most remarkable support person for me. A therapist, I call support person. Oh my God, that's some power. There's a lot of ginger in there. Martha wrote this book, Overcoming the Fear of Success. Okay, now wait a minute, time out. The first reaction that people have when they see the title of Martha's book is, wait a minute, nobody's afraid of success. What people are afraid of is failure. Nah. by the way, you see that little corner? That's my cat. My cat eats books. I can't figure it out. I can't figure it out, but there you are. You know, everyone has their own sexual preferences. All right, so here's an example. There was one of Martha's patients, clients, was a very famous songwriter who Martha taught up at Columbia. She passed away some years ago. She took this fellow up to her class, and he did a reversal on her. She wasn't ready for this. He looked at the class and said, okay, Martha doesn't know I was going to tell you this. Forget about this whole idea of overcoming fear of success. He says, I love success. I love it. My worst song got a Grammy. You know, it's very... There's no such thing as fear of success. So one of Martha's students, very insightful young woman, says, okay, I have a question for you. Did you always want to be a songwriter? And he said, well, no, actually, I wanted to play piano is what I wanted to do. So she says, well, how come you didn't go in that path? Why did you? He said, well, you know, I came from a very poor family. We had no money at all. And they were simply more money writing songs than playing piano. You know, and My parents depended on me to support the family. I was the only one making any money, so I had to. I had to become. Well, but now you're very famous and successful, she says. Why don't you go and follow that dream now? And he kind of thought about it and looked sheepishly down at the floor and said, you know, it's funny, over the years, whenever I've tried to do that, somehow, for some mysterious reason, I keep burning my fingers. Some mysterious, okay, that's like saying for some mysterious reason I got pregnant. Or some mysterious reason I got overweight. You know, for some mysterious reason I keep, you know, getting into car crashes. All very, very effective examples of what we might call self-sabotaging behavior, or what Martha calls the fear of success, right? Success in the sense that Martha uses that word, it doesn't just mean a lot of money. She's talking about success in the sense of living a full, meaningful life, the lack of which makes external success seem very hollow and meaningless. So fear of success refers to not getting what you most want in your life, because unconsciously you feel you don't deserve it. We're cut off from that sense of ourselves as eternal beings, worthy of all kinds of wonderful things. And we've substituted that healthy self-awareness with this low self-esteem and this creepy sensation that maybe I'm nothing but a fraud. Right? I'll give you an example. Right. Take a perfectly healthy young child who pretends that she can't read. Now, why does she pretend that she can't read? Are there anyone here named Patricia? No, Patricia's here. Yeah. Okay. Oh, you're Patricia. Yes. Okay. How about Jody? Anybody named Jody? Okay. So we'll call this little girl Jody. I don't want anyone thinking of it. Let's say Jody's parents are fighting, and she really thinks that they're going to get divorced. They're going to break up. So she pretends to have a reading problem. Why? Because when the call comes from her teacher in school, the parents have to stop fighting with each other and give attention to her. Right? So as long as she pretends to have this problem that she's an underachiever, she thinks her parents are going to stop fighting, they won't split up. And so some children will consciously fail at school in order to keep their family together, and as adults we sometimes fall into similar behavior patterns. Here's another example. Let's say that you grew up with a father who didn't know how to encourage you and who had a sense of low self-esteem about himself, so that whenever you did something good in school, you got an A on a paper, you won a prize at a sports competition or whatever, you came home, the response that you got was indifference, silence. Okay, if you don't get the attention that you need as a child by achieving something, by succeeding, how will you get that attention? What will you do? Okay, you do bad things. You're going to fail because you might get yelled at, but at least you're getting the attention that you need so much. And if the only way you could get attention growing up was to fail or to go passive, well, maybe today you might be letting other people take advantage of you because you think it's the only way that you will be accepted. Now, this stuff is very deeply embedded in memory. This isn't something that we're consciously thinking of. Most of our behavioral patterns were established so early in life that it may be impossible even to retrieve those moments and understand what they were or how they acted on us. Anybody here have sisters or brothers? Okay, well maybe you'll identify with this example that Martha gave, that she tells of a patient who could never finish her college degree. In therapy, this young woman remembered that when she had been growing up, she was the preferred child among her sisters. And the younger sister never did as well as she did. And so the parents, bless their hearts, would turn to them and say, well, at least one of our kids turned out okay. So this woman could never finish her college degree because she saw her success as coming at the price of her parents rejecting her younger sister. If you've ever had alcoholism in your family, sometimes a child will think, you know, if I had been a better child, maybe they wouldn't have had to drink so much. You know, it's my fault. I'm the bad person. Right? I'm not worthy of success in life. Look what I did. And I work with Holocaust survivors. There's one woman in particular I remember who talked about in the camps being told so often and just being, you know, force-fed this image of herself as not human, as less than human. That years later, after liberation, when she'd be setting the holiday dinner for her family, at everyone else's plate she would put a crystal goblet, and at her own place she would put a paper cup. And she wasn't even aware that she was doing it. I don't deserve a nice glass like everybody else, because I'm not a human. I'm a bacteria, like they said. You know, I don't deserve it. So if you're a yoga instructor, it might be they say nice things about my classes, but if they really knew me, they'd see that I'm not advanced at all. I'm just a pretender. If I'm such a great instructor, how come I can't hold down a job or a relationship or pay my bills? You fill in the blanks for yourself. So what is the ultimate fear of success? The ultimate fear of success. Well, if we go back to connecting sexuality and death, the ultimate fear of success is dying. That this is going to kill me. One of Martha's patients was Richard Dreyfuss. And one year he was up for an Oscar. My voice is changing. And Martha asked him, so how do you feel about being, you know, nominated for an Academy Award? And he thought a minute and he said, this one's probably worth cancer. Meaning, what am I going to have to pay? I'm going to get something good's going to happen to me. What's the price? What am I going to have to pay for this? I remember the first time I had a book published and I actually got good reviews, you know, and was starting to sell. I had a recurring dream that these guys, you know, like Will Smith in Men in Black, you know, in dark suits and sunglasses, would pull up in front of my house with a big van, knock on the door and say, we've got your number green, we're taking it all back. So fear of success, because we really don't think that we're worthy of that. Bring it all back to this forgetfulness of the true self and this horrible, tragic propensity that we have to identify with the sad experiences of our provisional material life. Anyone recognize this movie? When Harry Met Sally?
There's
nothing up there? Oh, that's why, because you can't see. All right, well, never mind. Anyway, so what is that fear of relationships? Bringing it back to the subject. Because once someone gets to know me, they'll see how flawed I am. They're going to want to leave. So why bother? Why even bother getting started? It's never going to work. Or we say, I don't know anybody that has a good, healthy relationship. Why should I be entitled to have a good, healthy relationship? So what has this all got to do with sexuality? It's that very often when we say, I love you, what we're saying is, I really don't think very highly of myself. And if I let you play with my body, and if you let me play with your body, maybe for a while at least, I can escape some of that sense of unworthiness by getting some of the attention and feedback and affection that I really needed when I was younger but never got, even from my own parents. Now, this is not true always, right? If the shoe fits, wear it. And if it doesn't, don't. But for me, the trigger of trying to connect these two things, yoga and eros. Eros means this, this explosive sexuality of our core being, right? Was because it never gets talked about. Here's this core human experience. It's something that we all share. We're sexual creatures, and we never talk about it unless it's a problem, and it's always a problem. So here we are. Least of all in yoga schools. You know, yoga studios don't usually talk about sexuality. And yet, where is yoga going? What's yoga trying to do? It's trying to expose that inner atomic core of our true being, which is a very sexual creature. Highly sexual creature. And that can be expressed most productively, most rewardingly, least destructively, least hurtfully, when it is acted upon with full knowledge of ourselves as spiritual beings. Why should I love you? Because you're sexy? What? Why I should really love you is that you're an atma, you're an eternal soul just like I am, and you're going through stuff just like I'm going through stuff, so I can understand what you're going through. So I feel for you. And I like you and think maybe we can grow together. Maybe we can establish a partnership or we can actually grow spiritually together. So I'm going to shut up now because there's a lot that we could talk about. But I would rather hear from you. So whatever you got to say, say it now. It's 2:00. We're going to go for about another half hour, right? And then we'll break. And then after lunch, we're going to get into some really groovy stuff. Because I want to read to you some bhakti poetry and get a sense of what's it like for the soul to engage in its original sexual nature. So, but that's after lunch. That's called, you know, the cliffhanger. I'll get you to come back. Questions, comments, ideas, thoughts, reflections. Is this okay with you? Are you upset with this? Are you okay with it? Does it mean anything? Does it make any sense? Does it not make any sense? Are you glad you paid your $15 or whatever it was?
Yes.
Talk to me.
Glad.
Good. I'm glad you're here. Tell me more.
Well, there is comments and teachings about celibacy, and that's how you reach your spirituality, so it's nice to have a grounded conversation in reality.
Yeah, I agree. Celibacy is a very cool thing if you can do it. And you know, that's actually a great secret. If you can so come to terms, and this is Bhagavad Gita, come to terms with your life, come to terms with death, come to terms with your sexuality, come to terms with your intellectual self, your emotional self. Get to know yourself. We're not just talking about some abstract thing in there, some energy, some spark that's floating around. Get to know your life better. If you can come to know your own sexuality so well that you can distance yourself from it in a healthy way, you can become a very, very powerful. That's a great source of spiritual energy. You want to make some very rapid progress? Take a year off. It may sound like a radical idea, and I'm not talking to the newlyweds necessarily in the room. But I'm saying that celibacy is a very, very powerful tool of spiritual practice. It's not unhealthy. It's not like it's going to be displaced and come out in some weird way, you know. You can actually live without sex. It's possible to do it. I don't think you can live without intimacy. I don't think it's possible to live without that sense of intimacy with other people. I know that when I left temple life, it was ostensibly because I'd met this beautiful woman and the sex was volcanic. The real reason was much deeper than that. I wasn't feeling the greater intimacy with the ashram around me, that larger community around me, was somehow failing to give me the satisfaction of feeling like we're really able to talk together. And if you don't have that, if you don't have that sense of community, then the sexual energy gets more important and it gets displaced and comes out in other ways. But if you can do it, it's great. The name, but I'm not familiar with the talks.
Okay. Well, he says something about the two paths to God, that there's love and meditation. And love is the harder because there's so many pitfalls. But he talks about sex and jealousy and celibacy and how the people that lay, even though celibacy is a really good thing, I've done it for about a year and found that I felt more clear at the end of that year and more, you know, able to go back to that, like, with a better sense of myself. But he says that it's tricky because if it's not genuine, like, if you still really want sex and you're just sort of faking it, that it can be, like really dangerous in that way. But I guess, but something you said reminded me of what he said. He said, you know, you just do it until, like, you're sick of it, until you've had enough. Or you just, like, you allow yourself to do the pleasure seeking. Until it almost becomes, I mean, it doesn't have to get this bad. You see the ugliness of it in a way. And then you're like truly come to a place where, like, okay, I've had enough, I ate too much, or whatever.
Right.
And then you really, like, can put it down
right.
for a while. And that's like, and then the, you know, that's like true celibacy.
Well, the psychology word for that is saturation, but
okay.
it's risky. It's risky because we pull the wool over our own eyes too easily and can use that as an excuse for indulging in the very things that are dangerous or harmful to us. So you got to be careful with that. Preliminary to deciding where you're going to go is to figure out, first of all, who you are and why you want to get there. So let's ask some preliminary questions before we decide which path we're going to take, right? All right, so that's the Bhagavad Gita. The Gita teaching is, let's calm down, start with some basics, all right, and then we can figure out whether we're going to go crazy or whether we're going to go celibate or whether we're going to go something in between. You know, let's decide that later. Let's not make that our first decision. Right, so let's start by chanting. Let's start by grounding ourselves in some of the basics. There are basics here. You can't ignore the basics. You can't jump up to some higher understanding of our eternal sexual self without ignoring chapter 1 and 2 of Bhagavad Gita. You know, that's like postgraduate stuff. And people always want that, you know. And whenever anyone would ask my teacher, can you talk to us about Krishna and the gopis? He'd say, no. You know, well, talk to us about God and the cowherd women and their dancing. And he would say, that's over my head. I can't talk to you about that. And of course, it wasn't over his head. But he refused to talk about it because people simply don't understand it. It's too easy to confuse that transcendent level of expression of the soul's ecstatic surrender to God with licentious behavior, you know, in this world, which fuels the wrong kind of ego and can be terribly hurtful. Terribly, terribly hurtful. So, you know, we can talk about this stuff, but let's do it with our feet on the ground. Literally. Yes. I'm sorry, I thought I saw a hand.
No. That was going to be a question of mine. When, in your narrative, you talk about the most intense form, which is a mode of conjugal intimacy with Krishna.
So let's talk about Krishna and the gopis.
I see.
Okay. That's one of the three questions I hope will not be asked at any of these. The unfolding of the ecstasy of the soul happens in stages. The first stage is what most of us here in this room have begun to experience already, which is, wow, I don't have to live with stress. That's the first stage. That's the Shanti stage. Om Shanti Shanti Shanti. I'm not my body. I'm an eternal being. There is some meaning behind all of this. It's not just a bad joke. That sense of relief is the first stage of your unfolding or the uncovering of the ecstasy of the soul. It's not a very developed stage. It's not a very elevated stage. It's an important stage because without feeling that immediate feedback, you know, where are you going to get the enthusiasm for sticking to the path? So the first stage is, wow, there's something more than all of this stuff that I've been dealing with. How great is that? That's just the beginning. Now that's what technically would be called Shanta Rasa. How many of you like Indian food here? Okay. If the next time you go to an Indian restaurant, order the Maharaj Thali. The Maharaj Thali is this big stainless steel tray that comes with these little bowls on it. Have you ever had that? Okay, that's considered a full meal. A complete traditional Indian meal has sapta rasa. That's what each of those bowls is, different flavor, a different rasa. You have something salty, something sweet, something pungent, something dry. You have a wet dish like a mulligatawny soup or something like that. You have different flavors. The word rasa also applies to the flavors of the ecstasies of the soul. And there's what's called rasa theology, which is part of the bhakti tradition. And this is what we're now beginning to talk about in a very, very succinct, abridged way. So the first feeling, the first stage of the soul's unfolding ecstatic nature is shantarasa, this sense of there is this greater mystery out there. Isn't that a wonderful thing? But you're not actively engaging with it. It's just this, this sense of relief. When that sense of, wow, there's something more, is stimulated by a desire to go further, when you become a little enthusiastic in your yoga practice, right? And you want to do something with that. That elevates to the stage of what is known as dasya rasa. Dasya means service. Dasa technically means servant. The sense of Krishna is so great. Krishna is magnificent. He is the supreme divine. And that mystery of Krishna is pervading everything. And I want to engage with that. Let me offer some service. Offer prayers, offer mantras, offer my food on the altar. Some sense of an inferior acknowledging a superior. Right? Master and servant, if you will. God is the Father. That sense of the mystery is something greater than me. Dasya rasa. But there's a formality there. And when the excitement for wanting to engage in love grows stronger, that distance collapses, and what you have is a relationship among equals, among friends. That's called Sakya Rasa. Sakya Rasa means that God is no longer on high, but God is an equal, God is a friend. God is someone you engage with on an informal basis. You talk together, you do things together, as friends do. That love is extraordinary, because it's no longer guided by rules and regulations. It's that spontaneous thing we were talking about before, where everything you do becomes moved from a place of knowing that I'm okay, I'm cared for, my friend is with me all the time. And that's there in Bhagavad Gita. Ishvara sarva bhutanam hridayeshe arjuna tishtati. Hridi means in the heart. Krishna tells Arjuna, I'm with you in your heart. And that's the hallmark card. That's an actual ontological presence of divinity within the heart of all living beings. And you can experience that. You don't have to just take it from me. Chant a while, calm down, and just start listening to what comes from your heart, and you'll experience it for yourself. That friendship, though, is also kind of cash, you know. You want to go lunch? Okay, catch you later. When that love, that casual sense of friendship, is heightened and intensified even more and becomes a sense of urgency, that not just you're my friend and I love you, but I have to take care of you. I have to give you your lunch or you're going to go hungry. I have to look out for you. You're going to get into trouble. Are you getting into traffic? Wait a minute, there's danger there. That's a parental affection. Vatsalya rasa. Now we're getting into the realm of Mary, Mother of God, of Devaki, Yashoda, the maternal and paternal figures in the great stories, the great wisdom texts, the stories of Krishna as a child, Balakrishna acting mischievously in the home of his parents, Nanda and Yashoda, stealing yogurt, stealing butter, giving the yogurt and butter to the monkeys and the calves, and Mother Yashoda chastising him. That sense of, I was saving that for you. What did you give it away for? I wanted you to eat it so you'd get nice and strong and fatty. And Krishna looking up at her and saying, yeah, well, you don't understand. I gave it to these monkeys because they're not ordinary monkeys. Those monkeys are my great devotees. They're great yogis who have been worshiping me for lifetimes. So my love for them is so great, I would rather have them eat the yogurt. That's a parental affection. That parental affection is also, however, guided by social convention. This is how parents act. This is what a parent must do. When that love for Krishna, for the divine, becomes unqualified by any social convention, when the feeling is so overwhelming that, oh my Krishna, I love you, and I love you so much, you can do with me whatever you want. And this was the mood of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, the founder, really, of the Bhakti Renaissance in Bengal 500 years ago. Nadadang najanam nasundarim kavitam va jagadisha kamaye mama janmani janmanishware bhavatad bhaktira haituki tvayi. These were the prayers of Chaitanya. That do what you want to me, I don't care. Treat me roughly if you want, I don't care. Just don't kick me away. Birth after birth, I just wish to serve you and love you. That sense of do with me what you will, that's an erotic sensation. That's a conjugal love. That take me and do with me what you will. The only thing that I want is your happiness and your pleasure and your set. That's the gopis. That's the mood of that very, very unabashed, uninhibited, unqualified, unsocially regulated, damn the world, I'm running to Krishna. That's what the British coming into India in the 1700s could not understand. You know, these pictures of Krishna, these women and dancing and this, you know, this erotic poetry and playing of flutes and garlands and all this stuff. This, you heathen Hindus, if you're ever going to take your place on the world stage, you've got to get away from this stuff. You know, break the idols. Get rid of all of this Krishna worship nonsense. Come up to the Christian light where you can actually understand the true meaning of God. And no understanding whatsoever of the depth of that bhakti theology. None whatsoever. So how that manifests and how each of us here has the potential for unfolding that kind of ecstatic love for God, and how devoid of remembrance of that relationship, we now seek our pleasures and our satisfactions in so many other ways. That's a very, very deep discussion. Okay, record with the Beatles and sex with God. I'm in. So So listen, I'm not expecting you to, you know, come clean or, you know, tell stories you don't want to tell. But I would like to think that this has triggered some ideas for you, some thoughts. Yeah.
I was kind of in the midst of reading, it was like halfway through, and Mother's Day came. And my husband forgot Mother's Day. I woke up, and I said, Happy Mother's Day. I realized he forgot it was Mother's Day. You know, and it came to mind, I didn't really think much of it. You know, my kids said Happy Mother's Day. They're 7 and 4. They gave me a little trinket thing at school. And then the next morning, Monday, I wake up, and I'm like, you know, that was kind of shitty. Like, I didn't even get coffee in bed, or, you know, just something. And then, so it, you know, causes turmoil in the relationship, and I was angry, and then I was reading and reading, and I had that experience of, like, get over yourself. Like, he forgot. You know, I went through the whole things like, do you live under a rock? I'm going to buy you a calendar for Father's Day and like circle all these dates. And so it triggered in me the realization that, okay, I'm still seeking things outside of myself. Yet, was it a realistic need in a relationship, though, to have some kind of acknowledgement? Here you go, like, here's your coffee in bed, a tray of flowers, or something. But it triggered in me just the questioning of, am I still seeking externally for these things that I should have within me? So it's, you know, I'm still, I don't have an answer.
Well, it's encouraging to hear that the book can be of some value sometimes, and I appreciate that. And yes, it's nice to think that we could reach a place where we don't need the external acknowledgement in order to feel good about ourselves.
But we're human
and we live in this world, and frankly, he messed up.
Yeah, I mean,
you know, let's call it what it is, you know.
you know. But it did, I would say, bring us to a deeper place in our relationship. I feel communication, you know, opened up again. And
well, if I were to put my Martha Friedman hat on, overcoming the fear of success, I'd be asking myself, all right, did I somehow fail to convey the importance of this so that he would understand that? And if I did fail to convey the importance of this, why? What is it that I thought I might be sacrificing if I actually got that acknowledgement, that recognition? Is there something to me having to ask for something that diminishes me? We have a hard time asking for things that we need because it says what? It says I'm needful. Okay? So that kind of fear of success can creep in that way. Again, going from my friendships with people whom I consider to be very spiritually wise, the best among them, and they're not all the best, I can tell you that. There's gradations even among enlightened beings. Okay. The best among them are able to admit their humanness, and they take no shame in their humanness. In fact, if anything, it's what makes them so darn lovable. You know, is that they can be really wise and really human at the same time. And if I left temple life, it's because the people weren't human. I mean, you know, they knew a lot of Sanskrit, but I wasn't, you know, feeling the love. So I don't think we need to be afraid of our humanness. Look, all of this stuff that we're talking about, this isn't meant to kind of like throw some fear of God into you for being a bad person if you have sexual needs. Not exactly the opposite. It's trying to say, here's where that impulse comes from. Here's where that need for acknowledgement comes from. Why do we want that union, that yoga, with another person? It's because by nature we have it. We have it with Krishna. We have it with God. Right? And if that's established, then you can have all of these other unions, if you will, in a very happy, productive way. So it's not to deny it. It's to inform us how to address it. So I'd buy him that calendar if I were you. Question also comes to mind, because men don't forget. They put out of mind. The question is, what was he thinking that he was having to sacrifice by acknowledging you on Mother's Day? Huh?
I just don't think he thought.
Well, I've been inside a male body for a few years, and I can tell you there's more going on. Forgetfulness doesn't happen in a vacuum. Especially not something that's important to somebody you love. So I'd be, you know, asking myself, because I've learned to do this with myself. If I've neglected someone, I say, okay, well, no, wait a minute, what was going on there? Let me, you know, instead of running away from it and covering it over, that's Arjuna. No, it's like a bad thing, and I want to do it. The scriptures say, don't hurt anybody, you know, don't kill. Instead of covering it over, intellectualizing, rationalizing it away, go to it, go inside it. Don't be afraid of it. It's not going to hurt you. It's not going to hurt you to address the things that are getting in the way of what you want in your life. Read Bhagavad Gita, understand who you are. Chant a little bit in the morning. Get up, get out of bed, and instead of grabbing a latte, sit down in front of a picture of Krishna, take your beads, and chant, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. Do it once. Do it 5 minutes. Give yourself that spiritual grounding. And then ask the question. Because if you get up in the morning, and your feet hit the ground, and you're just back into that same mindset you were when you went to bed last night, then how is your relationship with these important questions going to change? Do something to give yourself that spiritual advantage so that whatever it is, and it may seem like a small thing, but that small thing could be the tip of an iceberg. How do you know that this year he's forgetting Mother's Day and next year he's going to forget you? I mean, like, all kinds of stuff can go through our heads, right? Who knows what our thinking is leading to? I don't know him, so I'm not saying that's what's going on. Okay. But I'm saying things don't happen in a vacuum. Oh my God, look around. I mean, look at the culture we're in. Do you have any idea what it means to be a man in 21st century America? It's crazy. It's crazy. You've got to be some Hollywood thing that doesn't exist. It's ridiculous. Pity the poor guy who has to deal with that image of what it means to be a man. First of all, usually he never had an effective role model growing up of what it means to be a good husband, a good partner, a good parent, a good friend, you know. So where's the modeling? There's no modeling, right? So to put expectations on people who've never been properly educated might be unreasonable. It's tragic, but it's also unreasonable. Now, as to why there are more women here than men, women are naturally superior to men. You have an edge. You have an intuition which allows you a greater openness to the possibility of your being. Most women, at least, I think, are not told from early life, you've got to be the man. Most women, not all. Some women do grow up with it.
I just think it's harder for a man to know his true self.
Well, it's not manly. You know, to be vulnerable, you know, to admit that you have the, you know, you're supposed to be the guy, you know, so.
Like being allowed to have emotions that remain at the side of the
Also, now also look around. The image of women in the culture, right? That, you know, sexual, you can't sell freaking toilet paper without having a bikini on this thing. Yeah. Everything is identified with that, you know, goddess, that absolutely unattainable sexual object. So when you're a man and you grow up with that, you know, as being what is your fulfillment, to get that, you're living with an impossibility. Got it.
Yep.
Yep. You got it. Which is why, and I'm talking now as a soul in a male body this time, I don't know what I was last time. What's really sexy is intelligence, a sense of humor, and self-confidence. Now, so come to yoga, come to Happy Buddha, chant Hare Krishna, think up some good jokes. And just work on your own inner stuff, you know. That it takes about 30 seconds in my weekly Bhagavad Gita classes at Jiva Mukti down in New York for things to go wham down to relationships. I mean, we could be starting off talking about karma and samsara and the gunas and whatever. It's like boom, what do I do about this, you know? It's like It's because relationships are really what makes life worth living, first of all. And that's really what it's all about.
You find life is simple. I shouldn't take you to be simple. The know yourself, like you said today, which is one of the biggest takeaways other than Arjuna. Mm-hmm. It's the know yourself.
Yeah.
For, as far as relationships go, if you're looking, and this is personal, like this is not for everybody, but for me, what I took is don't look for it somewhere else. Look here and then see what happens. So I like the simplicity
of those words. Yeah. Okay. Good. Thank you. Okay, it's 2:30. Let's take a break. Yeah? And we'll reconvene in a half hour. Thank you.